very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. American Warrior Radio has deployed. We're broadcasting from the 19th hole at the Coligard Classic PGA Tournament, and this relocation special is sponsored by our friends at Nova Home Loans. Nova can handle your mortgage in many of the states where we broadcast. Nova has eliminated the fees on all VA loans. If you're relocating across town or across the country, check in at NovaHomeLoans.com to see what they can do to help you. We've had Sebastian Junger on the show several times. I consider him to be one of the greatest writers of our generation. And one of the common themes you see in Sebastian's writing is talking about the responsibility that we civilians have for sending our men and women off to war. And really, that's why I do what I do. I never served, so I consider it my duty to support those who do. And that's really the heart of the reason we do this program. Today we're going to talk not just about what we as individuals should do, but also what communities as a whole can do. Joining us to complement the discussion is one of the leaders of a very active community support group, and then a couple sailors whose crews and families have been beneficiaries of a strong community partnership. It's my hope that no matter where you're hearing this broadcast, you'll be inspired to start or reinforce a partnership between your community and our service members. First up, we have Jay Bickley. He's the vice president of the Davis-Monthan 50, an all-volunteer group of over 100 community leaders that advocates for Davis-Monthan Air Force Base and its airmen. Jay is uniquely qualified to speak on this topic because, Jay, not only are you among the leadership of the DM-50, you also spent
27 years.
Okay, 27. Yeah. And you're still a young-looking man, but much of your years in our United States Air Force, and you retired as the vice commander of the United States 12th Air Force.
Yes.
Okay. Jay, let's start off from the perspective of the DM-50. And like I said, we've got listeners all over the country either listening or podcasting this. Let's talk specifically kind of granularly about the DM-50. What is your mission? What are the details of your mission in this particular community?
Yeah, so in the Tucson community, specifically for Davis-Monthan Air Force Base, the organization was started back in the early 80s, I think, late 70s maybe. Started out with 50 concerned citizens who wanted to support the base, and it's grown since then, 130. I think we have 131 members now, and that doesn't have the same, DM-138 doesn't have the same ring to it as the DM-50. So we stayed with that. But the bottom line is we support the base. We support the airmen out there at Davis-Monthan, and we do what we can to ensure that the community is aware of the things that are going on out there, what their military is doing. Mm-hmm. We also trying to make sure that the airmen have what they need, and that they're welcomed into the community, because a small percentage of the airmen that are out at work out at the base actually live on base. Most of them live in the community, and we want to make sure that they're supported and they're welcomed, even though they're here from anywhere from 2 to 5 years, and that's all.
In your role with the 12th Air Force, obviously you, with a career that long, you were in several communities. Would you say that the level of support in other communities is as high as it should be? I mean, I think that, you know, our flagship is here in Tucson, and I think the support here is wonderful. But have there been communities that you've been in where you say, you know, you guys could probably step your game up a little bit?
I think it might become from where where I was in rank wise or what my job was when I was in a particular community. So I was the wing commander of the 552nd Air Control Wing at Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma City, and they have amazing support. Mm-hmm. From the outside community. People are very dedicated to helping, kind of doing the same stuff that we do as part of the DM-50. But I'm a little biased, I suppose. I think that when we were assigned here to Davis-Monthan and I met members of the DM-50 and I saw what they were doing, it really was a large part of why I decided to retire here in Tucson and stay here and then get involved with the DM-50, because I saw the great Americans that are members of the organization and how passionate they are about taking care of the airmen and how much it really means to them to make a difference and to meet the airmen.
I just was lucky that one of the actual original founders of the DM-50 wandered through the 19th hole here a few minutes ago, so I was taking the opportunity to pick his brain. And the way he relates it is, before we had something like this here in Tucson, the wing commander approached him and said, hey, you know, over at Beale Air Force Base, they've got this group.
Yeah.
And maybe you guys should consider doing that. And you know, in his words, when the general says maybe you should consider, that's
right.
That's
right.
Not just a suggestion. So they followed up. Let's talk about what do you do. So give me some examples of the support that the DM-50 provides, in this case, for the Air Force families.
Yeah, I think one of the things we do, so for the young airmen who do live on base, we do a monthly loft dinner in conjunction with the chapel out there at the base, where members of the DM-50 will donate food and their time, and then they take a meal out to share with the airmen out on base. So they get a break, they get to meet some of the people from the community. So that's one of the touch points that we have with the airmen. We also do a picnic, which is coming up in April. Obviously, the COVID was restrictive on what we could do on base, so we're excited to get back out there, where the organization provides the food and drinks, and then there's also a car show in conjunction with it, and just giving the airmen an opportunity to get out and commingle with community members, but also a way of us paying back for what they do.
You know, that's something I've noticed is you know, keep in mind, these families are relocating every couple of years,
yep.
And it's almost like they've got to start over in their newer community. And having individuals who've been there a long time who can help facilitate those introductions, you know, they don't have to take 6 months to find out where the best restaurants are. There's
yep.
folks there that are ready to do that. But more practical things, that, as I understand it, DM-50, also one of your initiatives, Jay, is to help the spouses. You know, they're coming in, they're here for 2 years, their spouse has got a job in the
right.
Air Force doing their job in this case, but there's some tremendously skilled spouses who it's beneficial for the community to engage them and get them employment, and it's also helpful for the families.
Yep.
So that's one of your initiatives, if I understand it, to help place these folks and work while they're here.
It is, and I don't know that that's going, I haven't heard that that's going on in other places around the country with other military support organizations, but it should be. You know, my wife, we served 27 years, and it's a family business. And just about the time a spouse gets established in a career or in a job, then the orders come down and you're moving to a new base. Where it really hits home is for our professionals, teachers, nurses, doctors, where every state requires a different licensing. And so when they come into a state, and the DM-50 was able to work with the Arizona governor and in waiving those requirements. So if you come into, if you get PCS'd into a permanent change of station into Davis-Monthan, and your spouse is the teacher, then they wouldn't have to go through the recertification process in Tucson. They'd be able to work, you know, go to work right away, which is an incredible benefit, because it really does, it really is difficult when you're trying to break into a new market as a spouse every 3 to 5 years.
Sure. Well, and I would guess that the other side of this equation is having employers, business leaders who recognize you're going to get a great employee,
yep.
but you're only going to have them for 2 or 3 years, and they'll say, not a problem.
Yep.
Because most HR managers will say, hey, I'm going to be here for 24 months, and I got to go by. They're like, yeah, maybe that's not the best
yep.
interview statement.
Yeah, no, they do. And we've had, and that's what makes it work, is the community support for that. So we have a website, and it links. So if you know you get an assignment to Davis-Monthan, then your spouse can go on the website and then see what jobs might be available, and we get those from the community leaders, and then we kind of mesh them up for interviews and the application process and those kind of things. So it only works because it's a very supportive community. They understand they're going to get a great employee, but they also understand the context, and it's not going to be a long term for sure. So it's a great program. I'd love to see other communities around the country do something similar.
Well, you know, that's my hope with this broadcast, Jay, is that hopefully folks listening somewhere else will get an idea and get things started. In today's day and age, it's hard for me to imagine there's communities out there with a strong or even a smaller military presence that aren't stepping up. But when you talk about the DM-50, I mean, we'd have military here forever.
Yeah.
And you guys only got started in the 80s, so
yeah.
I guess there's hope for folks out there. Tell me about Operation Warm Heart, the program where you help the families during the holidays.
Yeah, that's a special time, I suppose, mm-hmm. and during the holidays when families are away from families, and oftentimes their active duty military member may be deployed during the holidays. So we put together food baskets. We also work with the base on candy and cookie drives, and they may seem like small things, But it's a it really does. And then some of the we're able to provide meals for people on base that may not be able to afford, you know, a full meal and for the holidays. So we do things like that. We also participate in the base. Again, COVID kind of hurt it, but they do a big holiday party out there at the base, and we support that, where the families can get out and celebrate the holidays.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Ben Bueller Garcia. We're deployed, I like to say. We're out here at the 19th hole, the Culligard PGA Classic. We're talking about community support. We'll be back with more from Jay Bickley. He's the vice president of a very, very outstanding community support organization called the Davis-Monthan 50. Later on, we'll be joined by two sailors from the USS Tucson whose families are benefiting from this type of support. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking about community support. Jay, I hope I don't offend anybody by saying that my radio show is deployed. Is that okay for us?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Thanks to Nova Home Loans, are broadcasting from the 19th hole at the Culligard Classic PGA Tournament. And just a little shout-out to the PGA as well. They're very supportive in everything they do of our military families. Jay, we're talking about what communities as a whole can do to support the military in their communities. And it's interesting, in the previous segment you mentioned advocacy. And that's one of the main roles of the DM50, and kind of the creativity that brought up when you said that about the spouses who might need some certification, but they're in different states all the time. So you guys went to bat at the state of Arizona to literally change the law so they could do this.
Yeah.
It's also important. I know Davis-Monthan was on the closure list, the base realignment closure list, and that's when I first got involved. And just going back to Congress and, I mean, the economic impacts in these communities are huge of these bases and those families. And then you're a perfect example of it, that here we have an extremely well-qualified, trained guy who said, I like it here. I'm going to stick around and become part of the community. So there's that after effect, if you will, as well. But what does the DM50 do, not just statewide, but it's my understanding you are very, you've got your finger on the pulse and you're staying in constant communication with our federal leadership as well.
Yeah, absolutely. We call it the Arizona contingent, so our senators and Congress members that we have a really good group here in Arizona, and they all support the military and a military presence throughout Arizona. Of course, not just Davis-Monthan. So we do. We have regular meetings with those folks. I also serve on Senator Kelly's Defense Advisory Council in ensuring that there's a future of that Davis-Monthan is in the future plans for the Air Force, and ensuring that when the day comes that the A-10 is retired, then other missions will come behind that, so that we don't lose that base in our community.
You know, Jay, I'm thinking about what other communities who haven't gotten started yet or maybe want to reinforce or up their game a little bit. I think the DM50 and the community's role in that first base realignment and closure was a perfect example for them to copy. Now, keep in mind, you know, in some cases, communities, we're going to end up fighting each other.
Yeah.
Because one of the interesting strategies in there, Jay, was the community put together not just the reasons why financially and logistically it was important to maintain Davis-Monthan and its missions. Then that group also went out and identified other missions around the country that were at risk of being closed and said, oh, by the way, Congress, that mission would work very perfectly in Tucson, that mission. And as I understand it, that's the way that Tucson got the 12th Air Force headquarters. I don't know if that's true or not. But
yeah, it's very possible. I'm not sure.
You were recently at a sort of a conference or a convention of these types of groups nationwide?
Yeah, we were just down, and it was in San Antonio, and it was hosted by they call themselves the Military City Organization, because if you're familiar with San Antonio, I mean, there's a lot of military presence there, not just Air Force, but also all the services are there. And so they brought everybody together, and we basically sat for 2 days and shared ideas and shared programs that we're doing in the DM50, and then other organizations from around the country also shared some of the things that they were doing. And it's unique, I mean, because every community is a little bit unique in how they do fundraising and how they participate with bases and organizations on the bases is really unique to a specific community.
So if someone's hearing this broadcast and they think this is a good idea, where would you recommend they start? I mean, can they reach out to the DM50, find you on the website, and, hey, look, we need some mentoring. Where do you...
Yeah, absolutely, DM50.org. If they reach out, we'd be more than happy to talk to them about that. One thing I would say is that for communities that that maybe don't have strong support organizations and are looking to start one, I think what kind of gets lost is everybody kind of focuses on, and rightly so, that what can we do to support the base and how can we help the service members that are on that base. But I think they'll be pleasantly surprised on what the community members get out of it. It's a two-way relationship, and so what they get to experience by getting on the base, visiting with, in our case, the airmen, and frankly, realizing what amazing young people these are that we have serving in our armed forces today. Every walk of life, they've all got a story, and they're all worth listening to. They're out there on post right as we speak today. That we have military members around the world that are protecting our freedom. And so the benefit of meeting and spending time with those individuals as a community leader or a community member is very rewarding.
You know, I folks who've listened to the program for a long time know this is something I feel strongly about. In my day job, Jay, I'm a lobbyist, which means I interact with bureaucrats and attorneys and politicians, which does not exactly build your confidence. Nothing but love, folks. But when I go out to a change of command or some other event at my local base, I'm just like, it recharges me.
Yep.
I see these wonderful young men and women, and it just makes me feel so much better about our nation and our community as well. So I'm glad you brought that up. Let's so the benefits. I also don't want to skip over the fact, I think the last study was done, focused on Tucson in particular, $3 billion with a B dollar impact in the community of having that base and those families out there.
So yeah, I'm not surprised by that number. I think that the state of Arizona is actually working on it. That I believe it started already. They're doing an updated economic impact study. Mm-hmm. So for the different bases for this. So we'll get some. I would say, well, you know, it's a government survey that's going on, and the state government is running it. So I don't think we'll have the answers tomorrow. but when it's
Welcome
done,
to my world.
We'll have updated information that we'll be able to share with people, because it's an enormous economic impact and that goes for every base across the country. There's not a base that doesn't have an economic impact on the community that it resides in.
Jay, I want to switch to another program that's near and dear to my heart, but before we get away from this idea, one of the first things, I don't want to skip over this, but if folks are thinking of starting something in their community, probably the first step is to check in with the base or the post or the leadership out there just to make sure that the
Absolutely.
Help is wanted.
There may be organizations that are that exist that may not be active currently or as active as they've been in the past. So yeah, that'd be great advice. You'd want to check with in the Air Force case. You go out and find the wing commander on that base, and see how you can contribute. And if there's not an organization in the community, then starting one, or if you just want to re-energize the one that exists, also.
From your perspective, from your time in the service, there's no unit or squadron or all those terms too small, right?
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
no.
If I've got 50 soldiers in my community, I need to take care of those 50
absolutely,
soldiers.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that goes for the Guard and Reserve also, which are really,
right.
really kind of in the smaller communities, is that some of the Reserve and Guard units. And one program that you could ask of bases near you is the Honorary Commander Program, and how you can get involved with that. I know that you've been very involved with that in the past, and being, I believe, what your General Rand's honorary commander, and so it's a tremendous program. And like I said, you may that they may exist in your community, and you just didn't know it yet. So by reaching out and seeing if that's something that would fit, for as far as time, and that I still have personal relationships with people who were my honorary commanders at the different times that I had the honor to be to command, and so it's a lasting relationship with those individuals.
That's uncanny, because you read my mind. That, as a civilian, that is one of the most productive and educational mm-hmm. things I'd ever done. And for those folks who aren't familiar with it, I guess I would describe Honorary Commander Program as sort of a two-year-long take-a-business-person-to-work day. I haven't been able to find out if the other branches have something similar, but it was extremely educational for me, and I thought I was pretty well educated about the military and their families. And boy, for 2 years, it was like drinking out of a fire hose. So, yeah.
I'd be surprised if the other services don't, but I don't know for sure if they do.
Well, Jay, thank you so much for spending some time with us. Thanks for your service. And again, if folks want to learn more and get something started in their community, they can reach out to you at dm50.org.
Absolutely. It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be back with more about how community support is so important. We'll be joined by two sailors from the USS Tucson. Now, you might find it odd, given that the USS Tucson is in Pearl Harbor, that a desert community has got a great namesake relationship, but you'll learn more when we're back. Stick around, folks. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking about the importance of community support for the men and women of our military, and we're switching the gears a little bit. You heard about a great community support organization. Hopefully, wherever you're hearing this broadcast around the country, you'll consider getting one started if you don't have one. Now we're going to switch gears and talk to two sailors who have personally witnessed over the last week some of the importance of community support. Joining us today, we've got Lieutenant Junior Grade Anthony Schlitt. Anthony, welcome.
All right. It's nice to be here.
And the USS Tucson Junior Sailor of the Year, Fire Control Technician, Second Class, Jose Lopez. Jose?
How's it going? Nice to meet you.
Listen to that voice. I've got more people on the show today that have got a better voice than me. I'm starting to get a little jealous. We're fortunate to catch these two sailors as they're making a namesake visit through their community. Now, Anthony, you're a Naval Academy graduate, so correct me if I'm wrong, but before the 1970s, naming ships was pretty much limited to surface ships. Naming ships after communities, states or cities, was limited to surface ships. But then Admiral Rickover, who I guess is considered the father of the modern-day nuclear navy,
absolutely
exclaimed and changed the course of history forever by saying, oh, submarines were named after fish, generally. But the admiral's like, hey, fish don't vote. So since then, we've had submarines that are named after cities and now states again.
That is correct.
So as a Naval, by the way, you're a Naval Academy graduate. Where are you from?
I'm from Mansfield, Ohio.
So we've got a couple of affiliates in Ohio. You want to give them a shout-out?
Absolutely.
Say hi, Ohio.
Hello.
What are you? Is that just me? I will say, I would like to take a point of personal privilege and also give a shout-out to your chief of the boat, Derek Derwin. He became a father just in the last couple of days. So, Derek, if you're listening, congratulations on a healthy new baby boy. When you were at the academy, I don't know if this is top secret or not, but at some point in those 4 years, did they tell you, oh, by the way, someday you will be responsible for the lives of 138 to 145 sailors in a business that is dangerous even when someone's not shooting at you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that really push the leadership and the responsibilities the whole time. They tell you and prepare you in any way they can for 4 years while you're there. However, once you get out there and actually start doing the job and impacting people like that, it takes on a whole different responsibility and weight to it. It's hard to prepare for until you actually get out there and start doing it.
Well, and that's something I guess, you know, you both have earned your dolphins, and the only way you can get that is to go out on a submarine and be tested in the crucible, right? And either they make it or they don't.
Absolutely. Submarines is one of the toughest services out there. It's demanding, both mentally and the stress levels as you're going out there. And once you're a dolphin-wearing submariner, it means you've proved yourself capable, knowing all the systems, being part of the elite club of submariners.
And now the USS Tucson is a Los Angeles-class fast attack submarine based out of Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Give us a broad overview of the mission of our fast attack fleet.
Okay, so the mission of our fast attack fleet is to provide nowadays the intelligence surveillance as well as
reconnaissance. So pretty much as a fast attack submarine, our main job is it's all about stealth, going to where we have to go, wherever we get tasking to go, and doing the job to get information that we need to put the U.S. military above and one step forward to compared to our enemies. And as a fast-attack submarine, when we get the word called upon, it's our job to go and defend our country in the ways that everyone knows we should.
Now, distinguish, because I think for a lot of civilians out there, our entire submarine fleet is nuclear-powered.
That is correct.
But it doesn't mean they're carrying nuclear weapons. And I don't want to talk about which submarines are carrying what weapons. But just because it's a nuclear boat doesn't mean necessarily that you're carrying nuclear weapons, right?
That is correct. Fast attack submarines are nuclear powered, but do not carry any nuclear weapons. Torpedoes and Tomahawks are their weapons.
So when you're out there, you're, as you mentioned before, Jose, you're going places you're not supposed to be. And that's, I think, when Jay was talking about the, I don't want to say burden, but the weight that you carry when you're doing your jobs, particularly on the submarines, if you're off the coast of some country that doesn't want us there, you can't just call time out and take a break, right? You just can't pop up and say, hey, you know, order Amazon, or we're going to stop in for a few burgers. I mean, when you're out and you're under, you're under.
That is correct. When we go out, we have the mindset of going out to do the tasking that we have to do, whatever the mission is on hand. That's what our job is, and we're going to stay there for as long as we can, as long as it's safe, because safety is the main priority. And as long as we can do what we have to do, then we'll get in there and get out in a timely manner.
Anthony, we're not making Los Angeles-class submarines anymore, right? The next group is the Virginia-class.
That is correct. The Virginia-classes are the next nuclear fast attack submarines being created. They go out and they're doing all the missions that fast attack submarines can do.
Is there any main differences? Is it a little bit of a bigger boat, or, I mean, that you can share with the public? Nothing classified, please.
Size-wise, it's about the same. They've got newer equipment, newer capabilities.
Technology overall, the technology has been more advanced compared to the LA-class submarines.
But our submarines are still one of the most advanced pieces of equipment on the planet.
That is correct.
Right? Excuse me, it's interesting. When we had the skipper here, oh gosh, 2 or 3 years ago, he was comparing, so people would understand, in a desert city, he was comparing a submarine to the space shuttle in many ways, in that you are going into environments that are not very friendly. You make all your own water, make all your own oxygen. I mean, theoretically, you could stay under forever. Not forever, but forever. I mean, you don't have to pull in for gas, right?
So pretty much we can stay out as long as, I'm going to say, the amount of food that we have on board. So we have what's called a 90-day loadout. We'll bring on board 90 days worth of food, and we're going to try to make it last as long as possible. But your food only is going to last to a certain extent, and then at that point you'd have to pull off station and pull into a country to restock on food.
Anthony, one of the great quotes I saw from Admiral Rickover when he was building the... Great, I've got the hiccups around the radio. When he was building the nuclear program, he said, I don't hire extraordinary people. I hire people with extraordinary potential, and then I train them.
That sounds about right. Admiral Rickover was a very interesting man. He was very demanding for all the officers and sailors that he brought into his nuclear navy. And, I mean, extraordinary people, or to train them to do extraordinary things, that's absolutely the nature of submarine service.
So a question to both of you, and let me start with you, Anthony. What makes a good submarine? I mean, is there one quality that you're looking for?
Discipline. I think discipline is probably the biggest component to it. It's you're pushed to do a lot of different things, work long hours, learn all sorts of different systems that have a lot of different requirements that is technically challenging. So just having the discipline and fortitude to get up every day and do everything that submariners do, it can be fairly challenging.
Jose, what's your take on that?
I think one of the main things that make a good submariner personally is going to be leadership. When you go into a submarine service not knowing what to expect, because it's a once-in-a-lifetime experience, not everybody gets to do it. So when you're doing what you have to do, you have to know that day in and day out, when you go to sleep, when you wake up, you're on a submarine with other men that have not necessarily control, but they're part of your life, and they take charge of whether or not the next day you wake up. So you need this type of leadership that's going to push yourself to become better, at your job, to become better at other things outside of your job, and then you have to have that leadership to train the people that are above you and below you to better themselves, because you go down as about 145 men, you come up, you want 145 men there, knowing that whatever you were doing, you're still together, and you create this bond between each other that you want to bring with you throughout your time on a submarine.
And I think it's important for civilians to understand. I mean, we don't that's the reason we do this show. I think so many of us out there don't give a second thought to it. We just, you know, we know or we don't think that you guys are out there on the watch or someone like you is out there on the watch, whether it's under the sea or in the air or manning a, you know, pile of sandbags somewhere. But submariners volunteer twice. I mean, you're volunteering to serve our country, but then you have to volunteer again to make the cut to be in submarines.
Absolutely. The submarine service is entirely volunteer. You have to want to be there, and it's a tough life. So it feels like you're volunteering, signing back up for it every day. It's rewarding, though.
Well, I tell you, I've had the tremendous opportunity to go to sea with you guys on the USS Tucson a couple of times, and I'll tell you, they could not pay me enough to do that. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. When we come back, we'll talk more with the sailors of the USS Tucson. They're just completing a namesake tour in their namesake city of Tucson, and there's a lot to be learned, no matter where you're hearing this broadcast, about what you and your fellow community members can support the members of our men and women of the military. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're deployed right now. We're out at one of the PGA Classics, the Color Guard Classics. We're sitting here at the 19th hole, and thanks so much to Nova Home Loans for sponsoring this relocation special. If you're thinking of relocating, whether it's across the city or to another part of the country, please check in with our friends at NovaHomeLoans.com. We're talking about the importance of community support, and we've got a really unique opportunity. We have two sailors from the USS Tucson that are just completing a namesake visit to their namesake community. Just happens to be here in Tucson, Arizona. Jose, you're the most junior member of the crew, but your role is, and you've got a great phrase on how you describe it, you push a button, things go boom. What was, as a fire control technician, what is your job in the submarine?
So as a fire control technician, I work on the electrical side of the weapons delivery system. My job primarily is when we're out on deployment or out at sea, I do the tracking of the enemy, and when we get called upon, we push the button and make things blow up.
Now, I got a look at your itinerary, and it's interesting. You and your fellow crew members spent some time out at the Raytheon plant, where they actually make one of the weapons that you employ or deploy, whatever the word is. For you as a sailor, for someone that's responsible for that weapon, deploying that weapon, what was your feel of meeting the men and women that actually manufacture it, and just sort of, I like to call it a Rosie of the Riveter moment. Some of our younger listeners might not get that reference. But when you're out there, when you're meeting them, what was that, how did that feel for you as a sailor talking to folks that are building something that goes on your submarine?
So being a fire control technician, we learn from the manuals, we learn a lot about the Tomahawks and all the capabilities of a Tomahawk. But we read everything that we learn is coming out of a manual. So we know the capabilities of our weapons, but when we load a Tomahawk into a submarine, it's in a case, so you don't even know what the Tomahawk looks like. You would refer to a picture if you've seen a picture before, but I've never personally seen a Tomahawk in person. And to go to the Raytheon and to see the way Tomahawks are built, everything that's inside of a Tomahawk, the warhead, the guidance and control, all of the technology that's been put into a Tomahawk, and to know that this is what I study. It was definitely life changing, and if my military career doesn't go as planned, I would 100% apply to Raytheon, because that was definitely life changing. I loved it.
Now, I don't know. I think the chief of police was working you guys pretty hard, trying to recruit you as well the other day. So, Anthony, is this your first boat?
This is my first submarine.
Okay, so this may not be a fair question, but given what you've experienced in this community, it's got to be a pretty good introduction. I know I've heard other sailors from submarines who've been on two or three boats say, you know, we've had namesake relationships with communities that just, they didn't, for all practical purposes, they didn't exist, you know, and it just wasn't. How warm of a greeting have you had this week in Tucson? And from your perspective as an officer, how important is that going forward for your crew members and their families?
Mm-hmm. So I've been told that this the relationship between the Tucson and its support group here is one of the warmest and best in the Navy. So since we've been here on this tour, we've been paraded around, treated like kings. It's been phenomenal visiting the city of Tucson. This is my first time here, but we've been taking all the sights, the nice restaurants. We visited the police academy, fire academy, greeted the chief of police, the fire department. Mm-hmm. it's been a phenomenal experience being hosted by the SN 770 Club here, and the relationship with the community is phenomenal.
And you also trained with the fire department because, as I understand it, everybody on a submarine has to be a trained firefighter.
That is correct. In order to get your fish or dolphins, however you may call it, you have to be trained in damage control, and a big part of that is fighting a fire. It's one of the biggest, between a fire and flooding, is one of the biggest casualties that you can happen. That's life or death on a submarine.
I would guess. And I got to tell you, again, you couldn't pay me enough to do what you guys do, because we had a Sailor of the Year in town a couple of years ago, and he was describing hydraulics and all this other stuff that, and I like, even when someone's not shooting at you, you're in a very dangerous business. What is your take on how folks have treated you? This is your first boat as well, I guess I'll say. So what, your take?
So I think you need a strong. So when you come to a submarine as a junior person, you don't know what to expect, and it gets to the point where this is a lot different than the civilian life. So you get pushed with all this stress, all these qualifications. That's going to it hinders your mindset, and there's a lot that plays into it. And you gotta focus on what's at hand in that moment. And when you're getting hit with all these different things from all these different sides, you start to stress a lot, and then you get to the point where you might think you're having a breaking point, where you're saying you can't do this anymore. So to know that what you're doing, people on the outside are still there helping you, and they're still supporting you. That goes a long way to know that there's people not only where you are, but from back home, your family, your friends, people you don't even know. Like, we've been out here. I've never been here before, but there's everywhere I go, people are thanking me for my service. And to know that there's all these people that are supporting the job that we're doing at hand to defend the country, it definitely plays a huge role. And it obviously gives you more, it brings up your morale, makes you want to keep pushing and keep fighting for what you're doing.
Yeah, one of the more interesting comments I heard during your visit here was the reflection on the fact that we're in a landlocked city in the middle of the desert, and nonetheless, people who never served probably have no connection to anyone who's ever served. They are not shy, and just the outpouring of support that you're getting, even in those instances. You know, it's one thing, I'm here at the turn, I'm guessing there's a lot of veterans out here that are shaking your hand and thanking you, but for those folks that have no connection whatsoever, just recognize the uniform and thank you for what you do, that's I would guess, pretty cool. Anthony, you used the word, we're going to make you rock stars. I'm going to make you radio stars here. I mean, frankly, I may be out of a job after this interview. You guys are such great voices, I probably won't make it. Anthony, given what you've seen here, how likely would you be on your next boat to, if they don't have a sufficiently strong namesake relationship, to really advocate for that?
I would absolutely advocate for that. The relationships between the people of Tucson and the USS Tucson are very tight. I mean, if I get that on, if I don't have that yet on next boat, be pushing 100% to be establishing those relationships with the community.
You know, and the Navy's in sort of a unique relationship. We talked with a previous guest about the Honorary Commander Program. But you're in a unique situation that you've actually got something, a submarine, a ship, an aircraft carrier that you can name after a city, and right away there's an immediate opportunity for interaction there, I would guess.
Absolutely. The opportunity just presented by being the USS Tucson and visiting Tucson, getting support from that community is very important to the submarine.
Jose, same question to you. You get your next boat, and you're now not just the junior sailor of the year, you're the sailor of the year, and I expect great things from you, no pressure. But when you're talking to your other crew members, and let's say there's not a relationship, your new crew members, and say, hey guys, man, the way they treated us back on the Tucson, maybe we should think about that, huh?
So I definitely feel like every submarine, whether it's your first, your second, or no matter where you are, I think there should always be a namesake relationship. Having this experience is definitely going to push going back to our submarine and then telling everybody the stories of how we've been treated out here, of the different things we have to do, different people to meet, and just the vibe of the city. And I know for sure it's going to push people to want to do the same thing, so that's going to push them to do better. And hopefully as the years go by, everybody can get the chance to do a namesake visit, because it's definitely worth it.
Let's talk a little bit about the little things. There's a famous restaurant here in Tucson called the El Charro. And on the submarine, the galley is called the El Charro Down Under. And as one wanders through your boat, There's things you can kind of see here and there that give you sort of that visual connection back to this community. And when you're out there deployed, you've got a lot of other things to think about. But would you say that there's kind of a little bit of a morale boost that you're seeing a visitor representation, that there's folks back home thinking about you and taking care of your families while you're out?
I definitely feel like seeing all the things that, obviously, I grew up on the East Coast, so seeing the desert in Hawaii, seeing things like that while we're eating every day, you go to eat and you see different things that represent Tucson, Arizona, and you're like, wow, I've never done that, I've never experienced that, I want to do that. So it definitely pushes you to know what's out there and different things you want to see to experience.
Anthony, your take?
Absolutely. On board, we've got plaques, stickers, we've got symbols of Tucson around the Tucson, and just a reminder of, hey, this is what we're doing it for.
Okay, real quick, I know you didn't know there was going to be a quiz, but here it is. How many windows on a submarine?
Zero.
Anthony, your guess?
Those are the ones that live in the reactor compartment.
It depends what type of windows you're talking about. If you're talking about windows to see, like, outside the submarine, that's different.
This is not the submarine at Disneyland. It was a trick question.
It's not.
I've been
not
told there's a window on the washer and a window on the dryer, so that counts as two.
There's no window on the dryer.
So now we're down to one?
There's a window on the washer. No. Yeah, there's a window on the washer. There's no window on the dryer.
We'll get the DM50 to call our senators and get that fixed. You can have a couple more windows on there. Gentlemen, I hope you're enjoying your time here in your namesake city. And when you go back and as you continue your careers in the Navy, I hope you continue to advocate for a strong civilian-military relationship, because I think you're learning here. I won't speak for you, but you're learning how important this is.
Thank you. Nice being here.
Stay safe. Ladies and gentlemen, you can find this podcast and over 300 others at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Find us on your favorite streaming platform, whether that's Google or Pandora or iTunes, Amazon, we're everywhere. Most importantly, folks, please listen to these messages, share them with folks who need to hear them. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. All policies and procedures are remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 300 episodes of this program via AmericanWarriorRadio.com or the most recent episodes via your favorite podcast app.